From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Ever felt trapped?
Open the door! It's locked! I can't open it! Open the door!
Today we'll hear a pair of stories about people who had nowhere to go. We'll learn about the fate of 14 crew members stranded off the coast of Tybee Island. Then we'll revisit a conversation about the dangers of leaving young children in hot cars. That's coming up. First, though, we raised a glass to Southern Spirits yesterday. We talked with writer and bartender Claire McLafferty about the history and evolution of the New Orleans Sazerac. And she says a drink is what you make of it.
As a bartender, you kind of learn that a cocktail's quote-unquote classic recipe is not necessarily how it's made. And a lot of the time, the best way to make a cocktail is any darn way you please.
We wanted your suggestions for the best cocktails. Do you have a special recipe? Here are your first thoughts.
Hey, this is David from the West Point area. I was calling in response about a good Southern drink, and one of my own is two shots of Jameson and a half glass of ginger ale and then two squeezed lemons. I call that the Wizard of Oz.
Mike Trillo likes his drink served neat, his favorite, bourbon in an old-fashioned glass. Black physicist tweets, a successful Southern drink has to carry with it a narrative of Southern living. And Mike Borowski writes, I don't drink. I will make my own lemonade with lemons, sugar, and water. You may have the bourbon. I'm not hard drinking enough to have bourbon neat, so I'll leave that to Mike there, Mark. We always want to know what you think and get your recipes as well. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. It's not a ghost ship, just the opposite, really. The New Lead Castellano is filled with living, breathing human beings who've been stuck off the coast of Georgia since April. The owners of the craft stopped paying their bills, so the U.S. Marshals seized the ship, just as a homeowner loses a house if they stop paying the mortgage. But that left the crew in an awkward position. They didn't want to return to the Philippines, and they weren't allowed to come into the United States. So for months, they've been living inside the bulk carrier, motionless.
The request came in that they wanted a Catholic priest to go out there and say Mass. It just so happens that the priest at the church is my law partner's brother. And so I called up Father Brandon and I said, look, Father, this is going to sound like a very unusual request, but I've got this case I'm involved with, and there's a vessel out at Anchorage. They've asked for a priest to come minister to them. Here's the deal. And we'd have to take a launch out there. And his response was, just tell me when and where to be, and I'll do it.
That is attorney Todd Bayard. He represents the creditors. Father Brannan has made several trips across the water to celebrate Mass with the crew. The creditors also arranged to have food and water supplied to the crew on board while the ship's ownership was debated. This week, the ship was auctioned off for nearly $7.5 million.
You have a U.S. Marshal there at the courthouse steps, at the federal courthouse here in Savannah. There was a minimum bid price set. We had three or four qualified bidders, and the marshal just auctioned off the ship, no different than you'd see at a house on a foreclosure sale.
The winning bid came from a company called MI Maritime Management out of Singapore. That bid could be confirmed next week.
The owner will have the option to either keep those crew members on board if they want to, or if they don't, they will begin the repatriation process back to the Philippines, and that'll happen in fairly short order. So they would be escorted to either the Savannah airport where they'd fly to the Philippines, or they might even drive them up to the Atlanta airport.
So, one way or the other, the crew on board the New Lead Castellano will finally get to go home.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic point aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailor man, skipper brave and sure. High passengers set sail that day for a 3-hour tour.
A Georgia father faces two counts of involuntary manslaughter in the deaths of his twin toddler daughters last week. Police say the twins died after he left them in a hot car. At least 26 children have died from heat stroke this year after being left in cars, says Jan Null. He's a meteorologist at San Jose State University in California, and he tracks these cases.
Every single one is preventable, whether it's the 51% of those where they're accidentally forgotten by a parent or caregiver, about 29% where children get into a car on their own. They're playing in a car, they're looking for a quiet place, something like that. Or the 17% of the children who are intentionally left in a vehicle not necessarily do them harm, but they think it's okay to leave the child while I, you know, go shopping, go to the racetrack, go have a drink, or whatever.
Every second counts when a child is left in a hot car. Null says in the first 10 minutes after a car door is closed, the temperature inside rises by nearly 20 degrees.
In Atlanta, an average summer temperature is 89 degrees. So that would mean after just 10 minutes, the temperature inside a car would be 108 degrees. After 20 minutes, it'd be 118 degrees. 107 is when about the body temperature that you see when you would start having organs shut down and deaths occurring.
Null says a child's body temperature warms up to 5 times faster than an adult's. Legislation in Georgia last year would have allowed most people to break into hot cars to free a child locked inside, but that bill never became law. I spoke last year with the bill's sponsor, Republican State Senator Greg Kirk of Americus. We are also joined by Jenny Stanley of Alpharetta. She lost her 6-year-old daughter, Sydney, 6 years ago in a hot car. Jenny told me Sydney entered the vehicle on her own and the heat overcame her.
She was looking for a craft that she did not complete in Sunday school. And when her friend was not next door, I feel like she went out to get the craft to take inside to complete. And she continued to look and look, and the longer that she looked, just the more heat took over her, and she couldn't think straight.
And your husband eventually found her?
Yes, he did. He and my middle son.
So in your particular case, legislation allowing someone to break the window wouldn't apply.
Well, it could have. The car was in the driveway. So if a neighbor or someone walking down the street, they actually could have seen her and broken a window at that time.
And obviously you would have had no problem with someone breaking
the window. Oh, absolutely not. I would welcome that.
But let me go to you, Greg. Your legislation addresses one particular slice of this particular issue. Would you have then ideas about how to expand it to maybe include other situations?
Well, what you're describing is, and I'm so sorry for you for your loss there, but thank you for helping champion this, because there's just so much about this people don't know, and so I want to applaud you for being here. What you're describing is just purely accidental. I mean, you know, I know on Sunday afternoons we typically take a nap, and we have 4 grandbabies now. All of our children are grown, but the oldest will be 2 later this month. And you know, gosh, if we were taking a nap and she woke up and went out in the vehicle, you know, those are things that just happen. But I would hope that this legislation would, you know, remove any hesitation someone would have to act on behalf of a child if they saw a child in a hot vehicle and to go enter that vehicle anyway.
So, Jenny, talk to me about what it is you say to parents. I mean, clearly we heard from the expert that there's a certain number of deaths that are still caused by people who feel like their kid's going to be safer in their car seat, left in the car, than running into the grocery store for a few minutes. So what is it that you say to parents?
You know, I just don't feel like that's possible. You do not have control of your child. You do know what circumstances are going to bring forth that maybe while you're in the gas station. I just say never do it. You know, your car could lock. You know, the doors lock on the car doors when you get out. There's just so many things that can happen that it's just not worth the risk.
And what are some of the things that you're suggesting as solutions? I mean, we've said before, this legislation would probably not have helped in the case of your daughter, but what might have?
Well, for instance, what about motion detectors?
Inside the car?
Yeah. I mean, we have them in the homes. When you sit in the passenger side, it recognizes a weight there to
for the airbags?
Yeah, second airbag. So why can't we do something similar and try to take care of, like, all, you know, possible chances? I think that would be great, motion detectors inside of a car. There's also so many other things. In fact, there is a company that has introduced a product, and I apologize, the name of the company has slipped my mind, but basically it's when you put an infant in a car seat, rear-facing car seat, and where you attach the buckles together at an infant's chest, there is some type of alarm or a monitor that is actually adhered to this, to the child's infant seat. So when it's locked together and the child is in there, it triggers a some type of response mechanism, potentially, if it's needed. So if an adult leaves the child in the car, a message is either sent to the iPhone or a smartphone to notify the parent that there's still someone in that seat because the buckles have not been released.
In case they're distracted, as Greg Kirk was talking about.
Correct.
So what about that? What other kind of things, when you talk to parents, what kind of solutions do people come up with that might prevent something that keeps the doors locked after a certain period of time? Anything like that?
I don't know. I try to suggest to parents maybe put something in the back seat with the child that you're not going to forget, maybe your briefcase, not to say that you would forget your child, but just something, a reminder. A lot of times this happens when parents are distracted or the caretaker is distracted.
Or they're doing something unusual.
Right, out of their norm, and they're just kind of on normal mode, and something different is just may not be in the front of their mind. So put something in the back seat that you're going to have to get. Your briefcase, again, is an example, a purse or your phone. And then I also actually encourage parents to teach their children that are old enough to get out of car seats to just lay on the horn.
Let's hear from Jan Nulligan from San Jose State University, and he's talking about laws in other states.
Well, there are only 20 states in the country that have laws against leaving children unattended in vehicles. That's only 40% of the states, and Georgia is not one of those. And there are more states that have laws against leaving pets unattended in vehicles than children.
Let me go back to you, Greg. Is that another piece of legislation we should have as well? Penalties, should you do that?
Well, again, each situation is different. So I think at that point, it becomes that law enforcement officer's discretion about, what I do with this case from this point forward. Do I contact DFACS? Because is this truly a case of child neglect? I don't know, perhaps, but at this point, I think that's where it's handled at, is at the discretion of that officer that comes and they assess what took place and does that make sense. And there's no excuses for it at all. But unfortunately, we know this happens in society. And I will take one disagreement here with the technology piece. I think it will be as simple as downloading an app on your phone that will alert you. So I think more people will use that, because I don't think it'll be a cost to the consumer of a vehicle that has that type of technology.
That was my conversation with Republican State Senator Greg Kirk of Americus and parent Jenny Stanley of Alpharetta. I spoke with them last year. Let's add a couple more tunes to our Georgia playlist. It's our collection of the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are really simple. All the tunes have to be written or performed by a Georgian, and musicians can't pick one of their own songs to go on the playlist. Today's selections come from blues musician Victor Wainwright. He's better known as the Piana from Savannah. He won the B.B. King Entertainer Award earlier this year. So without further ado, here are his two picks for the Georgia playlist.
The first song that I want to add to the playlist is Piano Red, Diggin' the Boogie, from 1951.
Let's dig that boogie. Let's dig that boogie. Let's dig.
As a piano player, and listening to Piano Red really resonates with me, because as I was coming up in the blues world, I was playing those barrel house clubs and venues as well, where you actually needed to play loud and fast to sort of get over the audience talking and people drinking and partying and having a good time. This song, for me, evokes a feeling of wanting to play an instrument and wanting to entertain people, just to lift their day up, make them feel, or help them feel better about themselves or about that day.
Let's dig that boogie. Let's dig that boogie. Hey, you don't have to know.
Well, I like that he's not afraid to play the piano, actually. Like, he really spoke to me by the way he played it, which was a thunderous sort of pounding left hand, being able to play a very percussive style, which just reminds me almost of a piano player that was also a drummer. You're starting to hear the beginning of what's later called rock and roll. And with artists like Jerry Lee Lewis and artists like myself who like to play genuine rock and roll music, this is a really just peeping through the keyhole of what was beginning during this era, which is rock and roll music. And this boogie-woogie that was happening was just the precursor to what later has become such a wildly popular style of music.
Dig, dig, dig.
The second song that I would like to add to the Georgia playlist is Blind Willie McTell's Statesboro Blues.
Wake up, mama, turn your lamp down low. Wake up, mama, turn your lamp down low.
When I listen to Statesboro Blues, I like to listen to his voice, as well as the guitar, of course, but his voice is just smoother and different than most of all the Delta bluesmen of the same time period or of the era. It really sets him apart. His lyrics, of course, are amazing, but his voice and his guitar playing are really, really different and very smooth and can be very touching. The thing about Blind Willie McTell is that he was extremely influential over a really broad and far-reaching territory of music. Later having, of course, the Allman Brothers cover his song Statesboro Blues, but also Bob Dylan paying tribute to him with his song titled Blind Willie McTell.
Treating me like I'm a king and she was a doggone queen. Just to tell your brother,
when my dad and my grandpa were teaching me to play the piano and to play roots music with them, you know, they wanted me to pick out songs that I liked and enjoyed listening to. And at the time, I was listening to a lot of Allman Brothers. By looking up Allman Brothers Statesboro Blues, I looked up Blind Willie McTell, and it really opened up this huge treasure chest of amazing early roots music that I wasn't exposed to before then, that I in turn got to share with my family, my grandpa, my dad, and we all took that journey. And so this song is special to me for that reason.
Friends got 'em, I got 'em. Woke up this morning, we had them Statesboro Blues.
If you're standing out in the streets where I'm from, Savannah, Georgia, just downtown, you hear things like the trolley, or you hear marsh or the trees bustling and birds singing. To me, it's a music that lives and is very much alive in and around the state. And to me, it just breathes very passionate musicians and folks that love to play and want to share that love and that experience of a state that is just entrenched in beautiful music.
Big 80 left Savannah, morning did not stop. You ought to start that color farming when he got them ball of hot chicken. Reach over in the corner, mama, and hand me my...
Blues musician Victor Wainwright from Savannah. If you want to recommend someone for the Georgia playlist, tweet your suggestions to us. It's at OST Talk.
Mama, sister got 'em, Eddie got 'em, brother got 'em, friend got 'em, I got 'em. I woke up this morning, we had them Statesboro Blues.
It's been a long week. We need that music, right? We talked about Bitcoin this week, police body cameras, and honeybees as well. So as we do every Friday, let's kick back, let's relax, and head into the break room.
Action continues, of course, and Michael Phelps continues his terrific form at the Rio Games. He clinched his 21st gold medal now.
We've been recommending flossing in dentistry for 150 years, and it's one of those things, there are lots of studies about it, but the problem is all the studies are old.
America has just gotten its very first pizza ATM. Students at Xavier University in Cincinnati, Ohio, will be among the first Americans to access a machine that will somehow manage to make instant pizza.
Joining us in the break room, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr, Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, also Hector Fernandez, a professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University. And here with us in Atlanta for once is writer and blogger Jessica Szilagyi. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
It's good to see you in up north there, Jessica. Normally, if we wanted to see you live, it'd have to be over something like Facebook Live. You like this transition? The latest feature on Facebook made headlines this week. A 23-year-old woman live-streamed a standoff she was in with police earlier this month. Facebook shut down the stream at the request of police. The woman was later shot and killed after reportedly aiming a gun at the officers. The social media site also deactivated her account at the request of law enforcement. So here we have a situation which could not have been predicted, say, 20, 30 years ago, right? And I'm wondering how we feel about the way Facebook and, frankly, other social media sites might deal with these situations. Requests from law enforcement to shut down or close an account. Kathy?
I can understand that police don't want their operations interrupted in the middle of an operation, but I still have a problem with Facebook closing down. And it's not just this account. It's many accounts of people who were live streaming video even after the events were over. So I think there might be a little bit of a credibility problem, maybe not in this case, but we don't know what happened.
Right.
For sure. And my other question is, where are the body cameras that the police were supposed to be wearing? Or were they not?
That's another question as well, which has not really been answered. Anybody else want to tackle this one?
I agree with what she's saying. You know, Facebook and these social media sites have the right to do whatever they want as a private entity. But, I mean, the comments, the desire of law enforcement for no reason other than, I mean, they had no public safety interest to turn it off. There weren't people out there rushing to the scene. They didn't even know where
she was in her apartment.
Right. So yeah. I have a problem with that.
Totally in agreement. And I'll add a finer point. I think when we see these sort of things happening in the Middle East during uprisings and we see, you know, Twitter accounts being canceled or...
It's happening in Turkey right now.
Yes, yeah. Access to the internet being, relegated by the local government. We call it tyranny. And here, I think we should call it the exact same thing. And I think the other issue, I took issue with it beyond Facebook just in making this decision, is that I believe the police have other ways to cut out telecommunications if they want to. If they want to jam a signal or cut off power, do other things that would stop her from live streaming without necessarily impinging upon her First Amendment right, then I think that those things are also available.
Hector?
Gee, I don't know. I think it's really hard to generalize in this case. I understand, you know, freedom of expression and everything, but I for the sake of trying to be fair to each and every situation, I think it should be dealt on a case-to-case basis.
Okay, well then, case-to-case basis, let's talk about a case of pizza. I guess there are some people who just want to move from something a little bit more serious into something totally not serious. And that is when you really cannot wait for your pizza.
The tab's 13.
You're 2 minutes late, dude.
Ah, come on. I couldn't find a place.
Wise man say, forgiveness is divine, but never pay full price for late pizza.
Those are the mutant teenage ninja turtles, but Xavier University in Ohio has made it a little easier for students to get pizza. Later this month, the school will become home to the nation's first pizza ATM, and it is exactly what it sounds like. The $55,000 machine operates 24/7. It cooks a 12-inch pizza on demand in 3 minutes. Okay, so the first question, of course, is would you buy pizza from this machine? The other one is what kind of hot food would you want to make a machine for, right? I mean, if you could have a machine that vended Chipotle, would you do it? Okay, let me start on the other end of the table. Hector?
I don't know. I would go for something Asian. I know it's not ideal for an ATM. The pizza, it just depends how they make it. I mean, if the pizza comes from a brick oven that burns wood, hey, great. But if it's going to be something,
I feel like they're not going to be able to fit a brick oven
to just feed the pizzas, you know, and then you burn them or something. I don't know. I mean, they always find a way.
Okay. Howard, would you eat this pizza?
Pizza, yes. I don't know if there's other foods that I would trust in through this same process, but I think this is smart on behalf of the college. They're taking some of this money out of the pockets of, you know, the pizza barons out there and making the money for themselves.
Jessica?
I think it depends on what time of day it is, whether or not you're going to eat the pizza and how hungry you are.
True enough.
But I agree. There's not every type of food can just come out of a vending machine pre-cooked. And
so you don't have a particular kind of food you would want to get out of a vending machine?
I love the cupcake vending machines. That's okay. But,
yeah.
You know.
Those seem to be pre-made. I don't think they're baking them in there.
No, exactly.
About you, Kathy?
So this technology has apparently existed in Europe for over a decade.
Yeah, they had it in Italy for quite some time.
Right. And other, I think in France. But the thing is that I don't think it would be that, I would try it. I don't think it would be that bad, especially up, you know, as a reporter 24/7 if you're starving.
Oh, yeah, we've eaten some bad food.
Yeah, I've eaten some things out of machines that I would not want to have again. But I would actually like frozen yogurt or ice cream to be dispensed from a machine 24 hours.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
Right, and, you know, all
like
the toppings.
Scooped. Yeah, there
yeah.
you go.
There you go.
All right, well, then let me put that out to the listeners. A, would you eat pizza out of an ATM machine? And B, what kind of food would you want to be put into a vending machine? You can reach us at OST Talk on Twitter or go on Facebook. And speaking of healthy eating, the Associated Press reported last week, there's actually no evidence that flossing has any medical benefits. Furthermore, the latest federal dietary guidelines for 2016 does not include flossing. So here's Atlanta dentist Alex Rodriguez speaking to Fox. He says, in fact, there's little hard science to prove that flossing works, but he doesn't want people to stop doing it.
Everybody kind of knows you can't let that just gunk build up in between your teeth. I mean, the amount of bacteria that is living on that plaque and stuff in your teeth, if you could see it under a microscope, you'd be disgusted. It's gross. You've got to get that off.
All right, tell the truth here, you four. Do you floss?
Yes,
I do.
Yes, religiously.
With those piddly little floss
You say a
sticks.
Prayer while you're flossing?
Well, it's as close as it comes to being religious, at least for me.
I had a dentist tell a friend of mine, only floss the ones you want to keep.
Yes, but does it sway you at all that there's no scientific evidence that it actually
helps?
Doesn't
matter.
You?
Your mouth is one dirty place. I mean, it is.
But we don't know if flossing is making it cleaner.
Doesn't
it
matter.
Like
anything
it
helps. Anything helps.
It yeah. feels like it does.
It feels like
and that's
it does.
Enough for you.
It is.
Howard, do you floss?
I do, but I use those little floss sticks
more
than I actually use dental floss. I'm ashamed to
it's
say.
It's still floss.
Yeah. Well, then yes. Check the box.
It's still floss. It's still flossing. Does anyone floss more than once a day?
No.
Once annoying
anyone who
enough.
Tells you they do, they're lying.
Yeah.
That's not true because I keep it in my purse in case something gets stuck in my teeth.
Okay.
Then
yeah.
I always have
That's
it
like
with
spot
me.
Flossing, though. It's a little different. Like, I just need to get this one little thing and then I'm back to it.
Right. Well, but it still counts, right?
Well, okay, some people do that. Yeah.
Why? We have a couple minutes left here, and I want to get to the bottom of why you don't care that there's no scientific evidence.
Because it's like every other medical thing where there's an opinion on both sides, and it's just about what works for you. There's people who never floss and have beautiful teeth and.
Really?
I mean.
I haven't seen many of those.
I think that they didn't do the studies properly, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't work.
You don't trust the science.
Or the approach to the science.
The approach to the science,
yeah.
Right.
I could see that.
Okay. All right. Well, again, we'll have to put this out to our listeners. Listen, tell the truth. We know that everybody doesn't floss every day. So if all of you come back saying you floss every day, I'm going to know to be skeptical, not just to the science, but of you. So let us know if you floss and whether it matters that science tells us it doesn't count or work at OST Talk or find us on Facebook. My guests right now are former NPR correspondent Kathy Lord, Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez, and blogger Jessica Szilagyi. It is Friday. We are in the break room, and you can join the conversation with us. Just ahead, we will talk about segregated classrooms, the Summer Olympics, and the appeal of ugly food. How many of you guys are watching the Summer Olympics?
Yes.
Not me.
Kathy Lord. Oh, okay.
No.
Yes.
So we have something
yes.
to talk about,
okay,
and Kathy
good.
Is sleep deprived because she's watching too much.
Right.
We'll get back to that. This is On Second Thought.
It's fun to do. It's a healthy way. Oh, take all the fruit that you want to eat. It's going to be a fruit salad treat, the first step.
Okay, so Moraine Valley Community College in Illinois recently announced it will offer certain classes
only to African-American students. School officials say those classes can be effective because students will build support networks by taking the course with those who have perhaps a more similar background. They're saying that this is part of an effort to get people to finish college. There's a certain number of students that drop out. We talked about that on this show. So what do we think about this? Can segregating classes or creating classes only for one type of demographic, can that help or hurt students? And I got to go with you, Hector, because you're our professor.
Actually, it's both. I'll give you an example. Women's college. Academically speaking, research shows that women perform better academically when they're not surrounded by men. But then again, what that means in terms of exposure to diversity, real-life working conditions, not to mention socializing with the opposite sex, that has all the other implications. So it's both. It's good and bad.
Yeah, I have to chime in here. I went to an all-male college. It also happened to be historically black at Morehouse College. It was a great experience. I wouldn't trade it for the world. And I think there are some good intentions wrapped up in here somewhere, but I don't think that this execution is what I would recommend. My concern is the stigma that comes to be a part of this. And I think finding ways to build support systems can be done in and outside the classroom without limiting who can take the classes. So if it's putting together study groups or getting people to socialize around being prepared to finish school, which I've seen schools like mine do. I think we have an average graduation timeline or duration of 5 years, and the school has tried to make efforts to address that. I think there are ways to do that without saying you can go to this class and you can't.
So we do have an update. Apparently, Marin Community College is not going to do the segregated classes because there was such a strong backlash. But it still leaves the question of, can segregated classes, what if it was a class only for immigrant students?
See, I have a problem with it from the standpoint that these are public. Morehouse is a private school.
It is.
Using tax dollars or public funds and having classes only be available for a certain type of person bothers me. The other problem I have is the class that they were sectioning off was on diversity. So, I mean, I have a huge problem with that.
Courses should be open to anyone. I think students self-select anyway. They'll take what they want to take. I mean, some of this were required sections, but I mean, you're going to run five sections and say you can't attend the 8:30, 8:40, and 9:40 courses. You can only take it later in the day because you're not a woman or you're not an African American or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, the thing that occurred to me is like, even if somebody has the exact same racial background that I do, I could not be more different than somebody who grew up in, say, rural Oklahoma.
Right.
Going by my race is not going to mean that I have some similar background. I'm not saying that there's not something to be said for creating a community of people with similar experiences, but I'm not sure that you can do that just based on...
I agree. I think Kathy made the point I wanted to make, which is that students will self-select and they'll do this on their own, but having the school or, administrators, teachers suggest it is also a much easier approach to this.
Okay, so let's move to the grocery store where you have to segregate stuff. it could be that in the months ahead, look, I got to transition somehow, right? you might be seeing more quote-unquote ugly fruits and vegetables at the grocery in the months ahead.
Come along, Dorothy. You don't want any of those apples.
Are you hitting my apples on what they ought to be?
Oh, no. It's just that she doesn't like little green worms.
Okay. Nobody's suggesting they're going to sell fruit with worms in it, but stores are now responding to complaints from activists who say a lot of good food is wasted just because it doesn't look perfect. So here's the question. If you find an apple with a small bruise or a scratch or a zucchini that has a flaw, zucchinis get scratched really easily, do you put it back or do you buy ugly food? Will you buy ugly food?
Absolutely. I think it's a great idea. I did some stories on food banks years ago that were accepting all of this food. A lot of stores were actually giving them imperfect fruits and vegetables to give to people who were hungry. And I think it's a great idea. And there was plenty left over. So I think it's a great idea. I think they're sold at a discount, these fruits and vegetables.
Often.
In many cases. Yeah. So why not?
I don't have a problem with it. I don't buy it to look pretty on my counter. I buy it to eat it. So I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah, and a lot of the food is just going in a recipe anyway, right?
Right.
Hector?
Sure. I don't expect my food to be perfect. I mean, I grew up in the tropics, so I'm quite used to fruits and vegetables with blemishes or marks or whatever. I think it's a great idea.
I have never seen any of you in a supermarket. Like, I go to the supermarket and I pick the food that looks good, right? And I would also say, I think this is a great idea, but I don't think it solves a problem necessarily. I don't think there are enough of these activists to go buy all the bruised and ugly fruit. And so it's just going to be sitting there in the bottom of the bin.
So Howard,
so you don't think people are going to buy it even though it's at a discount?
So the discounted part is new, and I didn't realize that, and I think that might help. But beyond that, I think, yeah, people will pick through it as we currently do, and the ugly stuff will be at the bottom of the bin, and they'll be giving it to the Atlanta Community Food Bank.
I feel like if you grow any of your own things, then you are more forgiving of flaws in your fruits and vegetables. Because I go out,
grow it right.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but I go out and look at my tomato plants, and you know they're not always perfectly round and bright red. But they taste delicious. So anyway, we would love to hear from you. Would you buy ugly fruit? You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation on Facebook. My guests in the break room today, Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez, blogger Jessica Szilagyi, and former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr. Okay, let's talk about women's bodies. A new study from the College of Worcester in Ohio suggests women are actually becoming more accepting of their bodies. There's a lot of qualifications. Women are still much less accepting of their bodies than men are. And the study has found, however, even though women are not fully accepting of their bodies, the study found that that dissatisfaction has decreased over the past 3 decades. So, is this a good or bad thing? And I ask that because we do, of course, in the United States have an epidemic of obesity, which is causing all kinds of related medical problems. And some people say maybe you shouldn't be accepting of your body if you are overweight. What do we think?
I mean, we all know that women are the harshest critics of themselves and the harshest critics of other women. So I think that while the dissatisfaction acceptance might be a little more prominent just because of all the campaigns with like Dove and things we see in magazines, I don't buy it.
You don't buy that women are accepting of their own bodies?
I don't.
I think there's a long way to go. As the other woman here, I will speak up. I mean, there are...
Howard and Hector are like, I'm not saying
that. Yeah, right. There are a lot of different spokespeople out. There are models that are, you know, the larger size 14 models, Ashley Graham...
But they're getting a lot of pushback for featuring these larger size models, like size 12 models.
Or
on,
14.
Yeah.
And Cheryl Teagues just came out, criticized Ashley Graham, who's a size 14 model, saying she was unhealthy and shouldn't be accepting. And then Graham lost weight, and then they said she was selling out. Now she was too thin. So I don't know about this acceptance.
All this stuff is really complicated. What I will say...
good answer.
Great. What I will say, while trying not to step on a landmine, I think social media, Instagram, you know, all these picture-sharing apps have done a lot. I see people, women, men, whomever, posting these photos with these hashtags and these captions that are so celebratory of themselves and the things that they're doing. And I think so much of this has to be driven by some of that.
Well, I will say that medical studies show that being hateful of your own body, hating your own body, actually it contributes to weight gain and does not help you with weight loss. Okay, so let's move on to the Olympic Games. None of those athletes have any problem with that. The world has paid pretty close attention to the ongoing Summer Olympics in Rio. The game has already witnessed a number of milestones. The Olympics welcomed its first ever refugee team. They were greeted with a standing ovation.
Such love and admiration for these athletes. There are 10 of them, 5 from South Sudan, 2 from Syria, 2 from the Democratic Republic of Congo, 1 from Ethiopia. They are marching tonight behind the Olympic flag.
And then last night, American swimmer Michael Phelps won his 22nd gold medal.
This isn't even close. Michael Phelps is swimming away from everybody. He's got a full body length lead. Lochte is just fighting for a silver. Aguino should get the silver, and Michael Phelps has done it again.
Phelps broke a 2,000-year record. It's been 20 years since the Summer Olympics. We also got our first gold medal for an African-American woman in swimming. There's been a number of milestones here. Okay, so I got to start with you, Kathy, because you told us before the mics went on that you're sleep-deprived because you've been watching too much of the Olympics. Why are you hooked?
It's true. Part of it might go back to covering the Olympics 20 years ago in Atlanta. So I think I fell in love with it probably more then. But it's despite the commercialism, which of course we have, I really love seeing these athletes compete that especially you hear their stories and how they've made it this far. And it's a determination. It shows their lifelong passions. And I think it's a good example for young people and everybody.
And the tiny country of Fiji got its first medal ever, and it was a gold. But Hector, let's go to you, because you very loudly said you are not watching.
Yeah, I don't like the coverage. I think it's poor coverage. It's basically a nationalist festivity. It's a celebration. I mean, if the U.S. had a World Cup habit, then, you know, perhaps there would be a substitute. But in the U.S., it's the Olympics. And, I mean, it can't be that, you know, the only good stories are the U.S. stories. In the end, you look at the coverage and the amount of time that they award to the rest of the world, it's minimal. So it's sort of isolationist. And for that reason, I don't like it very much.
But if you're watching in France, don't they feature the French athletes?
Could be. I don't know. I mean, because they don't have a network, at least awarding so much attention and resources to the overall coverage. If you look at channels throughout the world, I mean, the Americans spend far more money into media coverage of the Olympics than pretty much any other country.
Yeah, Hector's comments made me think, and I think in preparing an answer for this, I'm shifting a little bit. I mean, I was probably for the first time in my adult life really excited about the run-up to the Olympics. First, partly because I was, you know, dejected about how this all came together, how much money Rio was investing, right, and how badly that investment seemed to be shaken out. And then you started to hear some of these great stories, and as Kathy mentioned, all these stories of perseverance. But what I did mention, and I think I might have emailed this, we only hear these stories about the American athletes. We don't hear the perseverance of, you know, the folks from the refugee team or from other countries that I'm sure people have worked just as hard and fought just as much.
Well, we are hearing, to be fair, we are hearing some of them. And in fact, on NPR this morning, there was a major example of a man who, and I think from an African country, who was living on the ground in the streets and
ultimately. We're talking television. I mean,
but we're hearing it both. And we're hearing some of those stories as many, but they're gearing it toward a U.S. audience.
I mean, the drama and the way they can it. I mean,
some of the drama is over the top.
It's ridiculous.
I don't know, though. I mean, I first of all love the break from the presidential election.
I mean, for that reason alone,
like, let it run. But I disagree in the sense that even though we're not hearing the stories, there's a sense of pride in all of these countries for their country, their athletes, and that's there. Like, we have a unity right now. Other countries are supporting their people, and I think that's just a positive. It's something we don't see year-round or once every 4 years, so.
That is true. And definitely, listeners, weigh in and tell us what Olympics coverage you've seen that you really liked. In the meantime, let's talk about helicopter parenting. Everyone knows what helicopter parenting is, right? Overprotectiveness. Researchers say that can lead to binge drinking on the part of students. They distinguish between good parents who try to prevent their kids from drinking completely and so-called get real parents who assume kids will drink at some point. That's more of the European model. So do you buy this line of thought? Are children more likely to drink? And I guess that's just sort of included in more likely to cut loose and do irresponsible things when they get on their own, right?
I don't know if
she doesn't buy it.
No.
Her face is so doubtful, listeners.
I don't know if it matters what kind of parents you have. I think when kids get by themselves, they make their own decisions, and many kids drink or party, even though you may not want them to, that first semester, and then you learn. You either learn that you have to study or you don't.
Anybody else?
I agree with that. I mean, there's plenty of helicopter parents who raise children who walk the straight and narrow and wouldn't dare have a drink until they have that sideways turned card. You know, I think
by the driver's license, which is vertical for people under 21.
That's right.
Howard, did you binge drink at Morehouse?
Absolutely not.
I can't believe you asked that question.
When I was at Morehouse, you know, almost 20 years ago, there were no liquor stores for miles around, and we were precluded from having cars. There's no Uber, you know, so it wasn't like it was easy access to get.
Fair point. I'm from
Michigan, and, you know, visiting Ann Arbor, I mean, much different experience.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I tend to agree with the ladies. I don't think that one type of parenting over the other is going to produce one outcome. I do think, you know, looking at how the world has changed and how much children are aware of now via the internet, via television, via their peers, I think it's hard, you know, to completely keep the temptation, the curiosity of some of these
you
things.
You can't protect your kids.
I agree, and I think that helicopter parenting may be more and more difficult, if nothing else.
All right, we'll go to our one professor. What do you think here, Prof?
I think in this particular case, I mean, all you can do as a parent is model behavior. But beyond that, the get real parents, in this particular issue, I think they're a tad of enablers. They're enabling the kids a little bit. I don't see a particular reason. If a kid wants to get, you know, booze, they'll get it on their own in any way. There's no real reason for a parent to be doing that.
Okay, we are out of time for the break room. I want to say thank you to all of my guests, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr, Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez, and blogger Jessica Szilagyi. That's our show for today. But we always want to hear from you, and let's hear back from this. What would you consider yourself a so-called good parent protecting your kid, or a get-real parent who assumes they're going to come in contact with all of that stuff? Let us know at 404-500-9457. That's where you leave a message for us. You can also reach us on Twitter. I'm at Celeste Headley, and the show is at OST Talk, or post to Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great weekend.